today, Dr. Mary Lipton, and that of a talk is New Applications or Proteomics Informs Microbial Functions in Science.
So I'd like to start by thanking both Vanessa and Tanya for the invitation to talk today. And what I'd like to talk about is some of the new technologies that we have in proteomics that helps us characterize the microbial complement within soils. So this is my ubiquitous soils are hard and doing, not hard, so doing proteomics in soils is challenging. Dave talked about this earlier. And there's a lot of reasons, and I guess I'm preaching to the choir on this slide, but there's a lot of reasons why doing proteomics in soils is hard. So our attempts are to overcome a lot of these challenges. The site I'm going to talk about that I'm going to base this talk on is in collaboration with Mary Firestone's group, where we're taking soils from Hopland, California, and looking at the effect of plants and microbe interactions on the carbon decomposition and stabilization processes within the soils. And what we're trying to do is develop and apply these proteomic methods to gain insights into what are the active functional pathways within this community. So I wanted to back up a little bit and talk a little bit about a proteomics pipeline. In proteomics, we start with a biomass, and this biomass can be from anything. It can be from soils, it can be from isolates, it can be from human cells, whatever we want to start with. From the biomass, we extract proteins. The proteins are digested to peptides and analyzed by liquid chromatography mass spectrometry. In the LC-MS/MS, the peptides fragment, that we get a peptide fragmentation pattern, which is very unique to every peptide because we break the peptides along the carbon backbone. We then use a DNA sequence that in silico, we predict the protein sequences. From that, we get the peptide sequences and can create a theoretical fragmentation pattern. And we compare the real fragmentation pattern back to the theoretical, and we identify our peptides and proteins. And for the most part, within normal systems, this isn't that challenging. This is the way most people do proteomics. However, soils create unique challenges that we need to think about, and we're trying to find ways of overcoming. The first one, and Dave mentioned this earlier, is protein yields from soils can be poor, they can be non-reproducible. So even from the get-go, let's see, do I have a mouse here? Even from the get-go, we can be limited in our biomass. The second challenge is in our DNA sequence. So soils have a high complexity, they have a high microbial diversity. If we have a metagenome, which we don't always have, we don't know that it's from the exact site that we're doing proteomics on, and we don't know that it's actually representative of what we're looking at. Even when we go through and we have biomass and we have a metagenome, and Dave mentioned this again earlier, is that the top protein in his study was hypothetical. And so we don't have a lot of the isolates, and even if we have the isolates, a lot of the proteins in there haven't really been looked at. So even when we get an identification, do we really know what it is? And lastly, there's a lot of organic contaminants and a lot of organic compounds within soils that interfere. But it's not just soils. Just to expand on this a little bit, we had samples that came in Whirlpack bags, and they were wet. And we did the entire process, and what we found was polymer that exuded from the Whirlpack bags that we saw almost no peptides. So there's challenges even in the processing, and you have to be very careful that what you're using is going to be minimal with the mass spectrometry. So soils are extremely challenging, and what I want to spend the rest of the talk doing is maybe unpacking a little bit of this and talking about how we've approached some of these issues. So we have a standard process for extracting proteins from soils. There's numerous methods that can be used, and we've published and other people have published some of these methods. One of the methods uses a blocking step where we take something that would block binding sites in the soils, and so when the proteins when you lyse the cells and the proteins are liberated, they don't bind back to the soils. From that, we can extract either proteins or cells. And so I have two methods here. A direct extraction is what I'm going to refer to as cell lysis on the soils, liberating the proteins, and then collecting the proteins from the soils. And indirect extraction is trying to extract the cells from the soil so we get a cell pellet at the outset, and then process the cell pellet. The nice thing about the indirect extraction is that we have an opportunity to do a multi-omic extraction that we are working on the direct extraction, but it is more straightforward with the indirect. So from there, we isolate either the cells or the proteins. We collect the samples, and shown on the side, and oh, there it is. Shown on the side is what I'm talking about the multi-omic extraction. So what we can do with the cells is we can do methanol chloroform extraction, where the polar metabolites partition into the methanol, the nonpolar metabolites partition into the chloroform, and then you get this protein layer in between. And so from one sample, we are able to collect the metabolites, the lipids, and the protein, and we don't have the multi-sampling issues. This works really well when we indirect extract and we have cells. It's starting to work in the direct extraction as well, but there's some developments that we're still working on. After that, we usually do filter-aided sample preparation, and what that is applying the proteins to a filter. You wash through all the things that can interfere with the mass spectrometry. SDS is one of them, and so we want to be able to get through. We want to get all the contaminants off. You add trypsin, proteins. It turns proteins into peptides, and then you wash the peptides through and do LC-MS/MS. So we tested 6 different extraction methods on the Hopland soils. The first was a direct extraction just with a desorption buffer. The second was we had 2 methods that used SDS. One was at 25 degrees, one was at 95 degrees. So the SDS denatures the proteins and allows them to be liberated. The fourth one was a MoBio kit, and I'd really like to tell you about what's in there, but it's proprietary and MoBio doesn't like to tell you. And then we tried spermine blocking and an indirect extraction where we used dispersion to remove the cells and looked at the cells directly. And the results from our experiments are shown here, where I have the number of peptides and the number of proteins for each of the extraction methods. And you can see that the MoBio kit actually pulled out the most number of peptides and proteins, where the 25-degree SDS extraction was next, with the direct extraction with the desorption buffer was the third. The 95-degree SDS extraction, for whatever reason, was the least effective, and followed by the indirect differential centrifugation. But looking at number of peptides is only part of the story. It can tell us that we got more out, but it doesn't really tell us a lot about it. And so what we wanted to do is try to see how these methods kind of compare to each other in a different way. And we overlaid the protein identifications on top of each other in this Venn diagram. What we can see is that about 1,200 of these are the same in every extraction method. So these are the proteins that are going to come off regardless of the extraction method you use. But interestingly, there's a suite of proteins that are distinct to each extraction method. So what this is telling us is that maybe not every extraction method is the best for what you're going to do, and you really have to do some research ahead of time to figure out what you want to do. Now, we will need to unpack this a little more to map what these proteins are to which methods are, how these methods compare, and this is what we're starting to do right now, is to try to correlate what is the difference in these methods and are we getting different portions of proteins out. So the next thing I want to address is the DNA sequence. And so there's a lot of DNA sequences you can use. If you have a metagenomic sequence for your soil, use your metagenomic sequence. But that can even have challenges. If you don't, you can use UniProt, but you have to be worried about searching a huge database against a very complex sample. And so you have to be very careful with the way that you pull proteins out and how you work with your data. And then you can also get isolate genomes and concatenate them together to form a synthetic metagenome, which is great because you usually, for the isolates, you usually have a lot more information on what the proteins are and they're already binned. But you have to make sure that the isolates you're using are representative of the sample that you're actually looking up, and you're not looking at the low-level protein or organisms within your sample. the metagenomic sequence has challenges as well. And part of the challenges is using a consensus sequence. Now, consensus sequences are great for genomic sequencing if you're for error correction. Oh, I have a misspelling in there. You see here that a consensus sequence is taking all the reads and coming up with the nucleotide that is the most common in all of these. And this, in a soil community, could be strain heterogeneity. It could be due to the fact that there are multiple strains in there. So if you look at this consensus sequence, it doesn't match any of our specific reads. But if this read comes from a strain that is very highly abundant, we're not going to match a peptide to this. So if this is the strain, we're not going to match a peptide to this sequence because it doesn't match the consensus sequence we're looking for, and we need the exact sequence of the peptide to be able to match it within the mass spectrometer. So this creates another challenge that we've thought about working with, that we've thought about addressing, and the way we're thinking of addressing this is to create a spectral library of all the peptides we've ever seen in any organism, going on the premise that Mother Nature is actually has a very confined space in which we have protein sequences. The peptides are probably going to be very similar between proteins. And so we've created a library from 120 organisms with 15 phyla. We've annotated them with KEG, and we have spectra that correspond to each of these peptides. We take our unknown spectra and we try to align the spectra based on the peaks that we see. Now, the nice thing about this is that the peaks don't have to match exactly. We can take portions of the spectra and map portions of the known spectra and get a fingerprint. Similar to what Vanessa was talking about, you can get a fingerprint of the peptides and match it back to our library. And what this means is we're able to identify more of the peptides using this method than we have if we don't have a metagenome sequence. It's great because we can then now do proteomics on samples that we don't have sequence for. But even if we have a metagenomic sequence, it either gives us more information or it backs the information up. And this was work done by Sam Payne at the laboratory and has just recently come out in publication this year. So the experiment that we did, finally getting the experiment, is we wanted to understand what the flow of carbon was from the atmosphere through the plants into the microbial communities within the soils. And to do this, we're using a C13 labeled CO2 tracker. And so the plants are grown in these specialized containers where the C13 labeled CO2 is pumped in. The plants pick the C13 labeled CO2 up. The carbon is exuded into the soils, and we want to see what carbon actually showed up in these soils. However, we didn't know that we could do protein-based stabilized isotoprobing in the soils, and so we knew that we could extract the proteins. We got to that point, but we didn't know that we could actually look for the label in the soils. So we did a preliminary experiment where we just applied C13 labeled glucose to the soil, incubated for 9, 24, and 72 hours, extracted the proteins, and then looked for the label in our peptides. So the question is, how do you find the label in the peptides? When you do RNA and DNA, you do differential centrifugation so you can see where your label is, and you extract it and do sequencing. You can't do that with proteins. So we developed a method that would allow us to look at the mass spectral scan and determine whether it was had peptide label or not. And the reason we can do this is because a typical peptide scan, which is shown here, has a number of peaks associated with it. Now, this is not time on the bottom. This is mass. And so every peptide we see has these peaks because there is there's naturally occurring C13 and N15. And so we get a distribution of of masses for every single peptide. So if we look at this peptide, which is just one of the ones we pulled out, we can look at the identification and calculate a theoretical spectra for that peptide based on known numbers of N15 and C13. And so what we can do is we can take the spectra and we can compare it to take our spectra, compare it to a theoretical, and determine the differences. And this is pretty easy to see by eye. You can line them up and go through and pull them all out. The problem is that for every experiment, there's close to 80,000 spectra that we need to look through, and doing this by hand is just not going to be possible. So we developed an algorithm called SIPR that allows the computer to go through and overlay a theoretical spectra, shown in the gray boxes, to an actual spectra. And if we just see the gray if we just see peaks within the gray boxes, we say it's not labeled. But if we see this extension of the isotopic envelope, we can say it's labeled. And so that what the algorithm will do is it will say not labeled, labeled, or maybe. And so we can then go look through the maybes by eye and say yes, they're labeled, or no, they're not. In doing this, we've condensed 80,000 spectra to maybe a couple thousand, which can be done pretty much in a day, whereas 80,000 wasn't going to be possible. So because we're looking for this tiny little trailing of the peak of the isotopic envelope, we can look at labelings in very short labeling times. And we've done this on microbial maps to as short as 30 minutes of labeling, and been able to see peptides that are being synthesized and have the labeling incorporated. The interesting thing is when we look at the label, or when we look at label incorporation, we're only looking at proteins that have been synthesized since the addition of the label. So we know what the organisms are trying to synthesize at that point in time. And so in the glucose study I just talked about, I'm going to show a representative peptide, which is just it's from glyceraldehyde 3-phosphate dehydrogenase. I should mention that this protein is the single most abundant protein that we've seen coming out of this experiment as labeled, so it wasn't really hard to find a peptide that corresponded to it. But we can see that it is definitively labeled by the extension of the isotopic envelope. And just to go through some of the results that we see, we added glucose to the system. So it's not surprising that we see a synthesis of transporters that transport sugars in there. We're actually seeing a lot of carbon metabolism. We see proteins that correspond to the glycolytic cycle, the TCA cycle. We're seeing the pentose phosphate pathway. And I agree with Dave with what he said, is that what we want to do is we want to take these proteins and elevate them up to the pathway level. So we're really looking at what pathways are being active or activated rather than what just look at the proteins. We see evidence of oxidative stress. We see evidence of protein translation. Obviously, if they're making proteins, we're going to see them making the proteins to make proteins. We're also seeing a bit of sulfur metabolism, and we're still trying to unpack a lot of this data, but that's not really the goal of the study. The goal of the study is to take C13 labeled CO2 and look at the soils. And I was actually hoping to have this data to show, but it's still on the mass spectrometer. I kind of ran out of time in getting the data off. But what we're hoping to do is take the data that we get from these soils and understand how the microbes are responding to the CO2 that's going through, and really be able to try to understand what the carbon flow is through this system. So in conclusion, what I'd like to just hopefully... what I've hopefully convinced you of is that the proteomic characterization from soils has challenges that we're trying to address. There's natural and artificial chemicals that can interfere with our analyses. What I would encourage anyone to do if you're going to do proteomics is to try a number of different protein extractions to see which one's going to work with your systems the best. And understand that when you're using a metagenomic sequence, your consensus sequence can also interfere with the identification of your peptides. And try alternative methods or look at isolates to just round out the data that you have. We have developed, and others have developed, we're not the only one that have developed algorithms that identified shifts in our peptides so we can look at what's labeled. What I believe I've shown is that our experimental design allows for the tracking of carbon through the system by looking at the proteins. Lastly, and probably most importantly, I have to acknowledge the people that did this work. I get to stand up and talk about it, but there's a whole suite of people that were responsible for helping me do this. Gordon Sliz was the developer of the SIPR algorithm that allowed us to do the SNP work. Carrie Nicora is our resident expert on extracting proteins from soils. And Amy Borrower and Richard White were the people at PNNL that extracted the data from the mass spec runs. And there's a suite of people down at Berkeley, LBNL, and Livermore as part of the Firestone group that also were involved. Aaron Nucchio was responsible for getting us the soils and doing the labeling. Ulas, Katrina, and Owen got us the metagenomes, and JP and Mary for leading the work. We have a very large group at PNNL that does develop and apply mass spectrometry techniques to the characterization of all biological systems. So we worked on everything from viruses to soils. And I don't think we've done viruses in soils yet, so that's one thing we have to do. And I'd like to acknowledge the Department of the DOE for the funding for this work. And lastly, what I'd like to do is I'd like to join with Vanessa to give a plug to the Environmental Molecular Sciences Laboratory. The EMSL is a national user facility, and so if you're interested in doing any of this work, what the EMSL provides is not just the mass spectrometry or the imaging or the capabilities of doing the work. It provides the knowledge base that allows you to solve some of the problems. And so what EMSL has is the capability of looking at the biological system and saying, hey, this may be the best path forward, and you might not be shooting in the dark. So I would encourage you to go to the EMSL website and look for the myriad of ways of accessing the EMSL. And lastly, I'd like to thank you for your time. So when you're looking at post-translational modifications, you typically have to go in and look for them. When you do that, your database becomes even larger, and so we haven't actually looked for the PTMs from just on the metagenome. There are mechanisms for pulling specific PTMs out, so phosphorylation, acetylation. We haven't done that in soils. So that's actually a different experiment that I didn't talk about. I just used the slide, where they're putting coupons of the different materials in there to see what absorbs to the coupons, and we're using NMR to try to determine what the materials are that have actually absorbed to those coupons. We remove everything from the rhizotron. So what we're looking at in the soils is we're removing everything, not just the not just the plant roots, but everything from the soils. Go ahead. No, we've actually tried. Well, if with those, we might not predict protein sequences. We might try to get peptide sequences, which that's what we're actually searching anyway. We will use any DNA source that we can find and search against. The searching algorithms have gotten really rapid, and so that searching one data set against a number of different databases is relatively easy. It's much easier than the extraction and the mass spectrometry. So we'll try as many different databases as we can get a hold of. We don't use, so we're not using human, and we're not using mouse. So there's a lot of, because the work within the group has a wide range, and we do everything from human tumor samples mouse plasma. We're not putting those in. I think most of it is all the microbes. I don't know whether he has the pathogens in there, but I was just thinking as you asked that question, we probably should add the pathogen data that we have because there's going to be pathogens in the soils as well. So are you talking about the peptide diversity library?
Yeah, I asked her how, so she mentioned that there's a reference database that we are matching the peptide, that's based on environmental impact. So my question was, how do you decide what the most relevant is?
I think we're just making the database of all the organisms, of all the microbes we've looked at. We're not biasing it on a specific pathway, but if we see the peptides from the pathway, it's in the database.